The audition went very well. Miss Grimsley was impressed and said she would take me on as her student. I got back into the car completely elated. We went to Forbes Piano Store to buy the prescribed curriculum, and I was soon re-energized in my pursuit of a career as a concert pianist. Years later, my father said that he was really glad that he and my mother took the chance of letting me try to break this color barrier. He then laughed. They were probably just relieved that you didn't dance on the piano. Our time is up for today. I hope you will join me next time when we continue with Extraordinary, Ordinary People by Condoleezza Rice. This is Rosemary Scalessa-Fergars, the Georgia Radio Reading Service.
That's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us for the Noon Book Hour. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the coronavirus update, followed by USA Today at 2. This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, we celebrate Cupid with the romantic comedy Valentine's Day.
Valentine's Day. It comes every year whether you like it or not. It's the day when your love life is put on display.
I'd like to send a dozen of those to the best girl at my school.
These for your wife?
I'm 10 years old.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't realize.
Where there's always a chance for romance or disaster. It can be confusing.
It's Valentine's Day today?
Hello?
No, it's a Monday. Valentine's Day always falls on a Thursday.
Use your head. That's Thanksgiving.
It can be complicated.
Alex and I were supposed to have sex today.
Love can't be planned.
It's not love she's talking about.
But at the end of the day, it's all about love.
So how do you guys feel about each other?
Oh my gosh, I totally love him.
And I'm crazy about her.
Savion wrote his number on my hand.
There you have it, young love, full of promise, full of hope, ignorant of reality.
My father said to me, you ever with a woman that's too good for you? Marry her. Happy Valentine's Day.
Wow. Greatest love song of all time. Rock and Roll All Night by Kiss.
That's a stripper song.
Yes, let's have another bottle of wine.
You're the most special Valentine I have ever had. But just don't tell the other kids we had a date in the bar. It's just a little inappropriate.
Julia Roberts, Bradley Cooper, and Jennifer Garner are part of an all-star cast in the audio-described Valentine's Day. Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 22 with fog. Tonight, it will be cloudy with a low in the mid-teens. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the mid-20s. Tomorrow night, cloudy with a low in the upper teens. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update for Friday, February 12th, 2021. I'm Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas. One note, I will be taking off most of Thursday and all of Friday. So our reports this Thursday and Friday will be pre-recorded reports from the Texas Standard and a few reports from NPR. One thing I do want to note is that as of Thursday morning at 10 a.m., the CVS pharmacies in Texas are now accepting appointments. The website is very busy, so you may have to wait a while. For updates and information, as well as to book an appointment, you can visit cvs.com. You can use the CVS pharmacy app, or you can call CVS at 800-746-7287. Once again, that number is 800-746-7287. Looking at the status of the CVS website insofar as which cities are fully booked and which are available, the good news is most of the cities in West Texas at 10 a.m. on Thursday, February 11th, are still available for booking. That includes Midland, Odessa, Lubbock, Abilene, and San Angelo. We will return with our regular format for this program on Monday. Now, here are our pre-recorded reports.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. We've done a lot of reporting lately on the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines in Texas, and we've heard mostly from officials and journalists across the state about what's working and what's not. But when we took to the Texas Standard Facebook page recently to ask how the process was actually going for listeners, we really saw just how much of a range of experiences there are. Texas Standard's Laura Rice is trying to track some of those experiences in a new project.
We sent a call out for your COVID-19 vaccine stories, and some of you responded.
Hello, my name is Doug Ramey, and I am 60 years old, and I live west of Fort Worth, Texas. I am a frontline healthcare provider. I have been doing this my whole adult life. The first 10 years as in EMS, as an EMT and a paramedic, and then for the last 26 years as a certified registered nurse anesthetist.
That means Ramey is an airway expert, and he knows about the devastation COVID-19 can cause. As a healthcare worker, he should be at the front of the line in Texas, and he says he was.
Through a link, I was able to find the local HEB pharmacy, not very far from our house, and I called them on Christmas Eve and made an appointment for the 26th.
Easy as that. And then for his second vaccine, he got a text to schedule and then a follow-up call for an appointment that same week.
So that process went very well and smoothly, and I'm pleased with how it worked, and I would hope that something similar would be set up for the general population.
But it has not at all been so easy for everyone.
My name is Edwina Bakey. I'm 77 years old. I'm a widow living by myself in San Marcos, Texas. I have high blood pressure, asthma, arthritis. I'm also on a waiting list at my primary care doctor's office, and I've registered at San Marcos Health Department. I check drugstore sites daily on the internet. I also check CVS, Walgreens, HEB, my hospital here in town. I'm frustrated, and I'm worried I won't get vaccinated as soon as possible.
Across the state in El Paso, 40-year-old Jamie Baird has similar concerns.
I have allergic asthma, and I take more than one controller medication, which includes an injectable twice a month. I want the vaccine as I fear that if I were to contract COVID-19, that it would be fatal. I've registered with my county and primary care physician, but the process is just too slow. El Pasoans are hearing that second doses won't be administered until March, while many El Pasoans haven't even received a first dose. My personal skepticism really tells me that for myself and the others in my community, we will not get a first dose until July, given the lack of available vaccines, but I really hope I'm wrong.
In Austin, 67-year-old cancer survivor Tom Phillips also feels this frustration.
And I went to the austintexas.gov login page and signed up and tried to register, and it tells me that there is no vaccines available at this time and won't let me even sign up. And I've done this for several days, and every day, of course, it says there's nothing available and it won't even let me get on a list.
He's considering a workaround.
I was talking to my brother up in Denton, and he said, oh yeah, we can sign up, and then when there's one available, it sends you a text message. So I just went and signed up for the Denton County website. It took me like minutes. It was not confusing at all, and I'm going to just drive up to Denton to get a shot because the Austin-Travis County website is a joke.
He has mixed feelings about the whole process and how it's being handled in different parts of Texas.
I'm pretty frustrated to have to drive 250 miles to get a shot, but I'm going to do that because now I know I'm on a list. I just got a text message on my phone saying I'm on the list. Pretty cool. I'm just trying to get this shot to make sure that I don't get hit hard. We have several people I know have gotten it, and some people's parents have passed away. So I think it is important everybody get vaccinated. Thanks a lot.
We want to keep this project going, but we need your stories to do so. If you're currently eligible to get a COVID-19 vaccine in Texas, how's your experience been? You can record your story directly for the radio by going to texasstandard.org/vaccinatingtexas. I'm Laura Rice for the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard.
Whether it's about the virus or the vaccine, we want to find answers to your questions about COVID-19. Throughout the pandemic, we've been collecting your questions and bouncing them off Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine and an associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard, and Happy New Year to you, sir.
Well, Happy New Year to you too, David.
The first question that we have for you comes from listener Katie Fisher. She has a question about the vaccine rollout in Texas. Katie asks, will Texas preschool teachers be eligible for the vaccine at the same time as other teachers? What do you know about that?
Well, I know that there is some uncertainty about how states will prioritize their vaccine candidates, but so far, Texas, for instance, seems to be following the CDC recommendations, and their panel has made recommendations that prioritize teachers, school workers, and child care workers. And so it sounds to me as if this listener is likely to be included in that priority group.
I see. Well, now, we've been hearing quite a bit about this new strain of COVID-19 from the UK that's apparently more infectious than the version that we've been dealing with so far here in Texas. And as we've reported here, just last week, the first case of this new strain was found in Harris County. So are there any additional or different precautions you think Texans might need to take in order to stay safe from this new strain of COVID?
Well, you are correct that it appears that the newer strains have mutated and are more infectious, in other words, more likely to spread better and faster. However, that means that the usual good common sense measures such as social distancing, masking, hand washing, all the things we've been talking about are going to be even more important to continue. Of course, vaccination is also effective against these strains at the present time. There have been studies to confirm that. So vaccination with our currently available vaccines, again, are an excellent way to minimize spread.
So I guess the message, as I hear you, Doctor, is don't just keep it up, but maybe step it up.
Absolutely. The sooner we get to herd immunity point, the more likely we are to be able to return to something like a normal activity, and the best way to avoid serious complications, of course, is social distancing, masking, and then vaccination.
One of the things about vaccines, and in particular the COVID vaccine, is the great deal of disinformation that has been out there on social media and the internet more generally. And we received a few questions, Doctor, about possible links between the vaccine and infertility. Is there any data that you're aware of to suggest that this COVID vaccine might cause someone to become infertile or perhaps to have complications with pregnancy?
Well, I am not a specialist in obstetrics and gynecology, but having said that, the news seems to be very good about infertility. There has been no evidence of infertility problems. Of course, it may take considerable period of time to be certain about that.
And more specifically, what about pregnancy, Doctor?
Again, it is very important that women in childbearing years consult their own personal practitioner about the vaccine, but the news so far has been good, and the vaccine has not apparently caused any serious complications in pregnancy.
Best thing to do, though, talk to your personal practitioner about this.
Absolutely.
Dr. Fred Campbell is a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School at UT Health San Antonio, and he's been joining us regularly over the course of this pandemic to answer your questions. Now, if you have something you'd like to ask the doctor about the virus or the vaccine, look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus, and you'll find a form there to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for joining us again, and thanks again for your expertise.
Thank you. It's great to be of help.
You're on Texas Standard Time.
Throughout the pandemic, rural communities in the Panhandle have been hit particularly hard by the coronavirus. Early on, they faced limited testing supplies and personal protective equipment. Then, last fall, many hospitals ran out of hospital beds. Now, they can't seem to get vaccines into arms fast enough. Texas Tech Public Media's Jamie Lozano follows one man's journey to a vaccine.
Let me call. Let's see what it'll tell me. Let me see, when was it I called yesterday? I was trying to get in for a second appointment.
Manuel Mendez calls the Lubbock Health Department to check on his second dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. It's still too soon for him to book his next appointment, but he needs to start making calls now.
All first-dose COVID-19 vaccine appointments for the week of January 25th are now full. The city is working with the state of Texas and the Texas...
Although his age doesn't qualify him for a shot, he's 58, he has diabetes, high blood pressure, and coronary heart disease, which does qualify him.
I'm just trying to protect me, and especially Mom. You know, I mean, I live here with her. I'll be moving out in June, Lord willing.
Open heart surgery left him unable to work, so he lives with his mom. His health conditions, combined with his mom's age, she's 80, makes him anxious to get his final vaccination. Also, his mom refuses to get her shot. He hasn't found a place to get vaccinated in Loveland, so he makes calls to Lubbock, the area's medical hub. But that has also been a struggle.
Why they're using Selectacy, I have no idea. I really don't, because it sucks. You try to get in there, and it throws you somewhere else, and it wants you to buy tickets for basketball. Come on, really? So I got lucky, and I just kept calling and calling and calling, and I got in.
Manuel is one of few residents in Loveland to receive a shot. According to state data, as of January 29th, little more than 250 Hockley County residents, which includes Loveland, have been fully vaccinated out of a population of 23,000. And most vaccines, according to health officials, have been administered outside of Loveland, in Lubbock. A few days ago, when he finally landed an appointment, Manuel drove 25 minutes to Lubbock Civic Center, where dozens of people stood in line for a vaccine.
You don't have to stand in line, you can just go to your left if you have an appointment.
For many, this is their best and really only option.
I think the frustration for the rural areas is that we don't have any idea as to when we'll be allocated vaccine or how much.
Back in Loveland, Bruce White, CEO of Covenant Hospital, says the facility has received 200 doses of the Moderna vaccine, but he doesn't know when another shipment might come in.
You know, we just don't know when we're going to get it. We kind of sit on our hands. There are several rural hospitals that have yet to receive any vaccine. It's hard to really understand the state strategy on how they're rolling it out. You know, I know there's obviously not about enough vaccine to go out all at once, and so it is what it is.
Data from the APM Research Lab ranks Texas as 30th among all states in immunizing its population, with just 5.2% vaccinated as of January 24th. White said there are plans for a mass vaccination event in Loveland if they ever receive enough doses to pull it off.
We have lots and lots of people, you know, calling for the vaccine, and how do we do this, and how do we get signed up, and that kind of thing. And, you know, the answer right now is advocate for yourself. Get the vaccine where you can get it.
That means getting on the phone like your life depends on it. I'm Jamie Lozano in Loveland, Texas.
This is the first story in a year-long collaboration with Frontline, the PBS series, through its local journalism initiative.
33 minutes past the hour. It's Texas Standard Time, and I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. The Dell Medical School at UT Austin has been testing out a program that could help combat the health effects of loneliness and isolation, particularly among older people. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports public health officials say loneliness has become a growing public health concern that is more urgent during the pandemic.
Didi Diaz is calling up a man named Earl. He's in his late 70s.
Hello.
Hi, Earl.
Yes.
Hi, Earl. This is Dee Dee.
Yeah, Dee Dee. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Well, doing pretty good.
Dee Dee and Earl haven't talked in a bit, so there's a lot to catch up on. One of Earl's granddaughters recently got married. Another granddaughter had a baby. It came a little early, he says. He also talked about a small medical procedure he had recently. It went well. The conversation then turns to weather. It's getting colder, so the leaves from the trees around his yard are starting to fall. Earl tells Dee Dee about that, too.
I've got Astrid in front, so I've been dealing with it.
Okay.
And then the neighbor's key. Then backyard, the neighbor's trees. They blow in my yard.
This call is like any other conversation you'd hear between friends, except it's a little more one-sided. It's mostly about Earl. It's about what has happened in his life, what he's thinking about, what his days are like, including the most mundane details. Dee Dee started these calls with Earl as a volunteer for the Sunshine Calls program. This program serves older adults who are often homebound and therefore pretty isolated in their daily lives. How often they get a phone call varies depending on the person. And the point of the calls is to get these individuals to just talk about themselves.
The focus is really about making the person on the other end feel that it is a time of their own, that it is a time of their priorities, their choices, their interests.
That's Minnie Callon. She's the executive director of Factor Health at Dell Medical School, which is a lead in this project. She says the program uses empathy as a sort of medical intervention for people facing loneliness and isolation. Callon says these simple conversations can eventually, hopefully, have a big effect on how people feel about their own lives.
And in that way, make them feel, for that moment, and hopefully it carries forward, that their past matters, their present matters, and what they feel about the future matters.
This project is a partnership between Del Med and Meals on Wheels of Central Texas. Meals on Wheels is a national group that distributes meals to older Americans. Adam Hauser is the president and CEO of Central Texas's chapter. He says isolation has been an issue among the people they serve for a long time.
It's not uncommon for many of our clients, if they didn't have a daily visit from Meals on Wheels volunteer, they wouldn't see anyone else.
Hauser says isolation and the depression and anxiety that can be caused by isolation has been a public health concern for a while now. But he says the pandemic has been like sort of an x-ray on this problem. Hauser says everyone can just see it a little clearer now.
I guess you could say this is one of the sort of good things to come out of the pandemic, is that people are starting to realize that older adults have very complex and significant needs.
And Minnie Callon with Del Med says these needs have become greater and more urgent during the pandemic. So far, the program has already served more than 100 people.
There's absolutely no question that with COVID and the increased isolation of folks, the interest in loneliness has ratcheted up. No question about it.
Callon says that's why Del Med also began conducting a study on the program. Researchers checked in with people between July and September of last year. They measured whether these sunshine calls had made them feel less isolated, less left out, and like they had companionship in their life. Callon says if they can prove these calls made measurable differences, it could be a useful tool in the fight against isolation.
It's one of several potential solutions that will then be available to folks as they think about how to intervene, not just screen for and recognize that the issue exists.
Adam Hauser with Meals on Wheels says it's more important than ever for people to tackle this problem as a major public health issue. He says isolation can affect someone's physical health as well as their emotional health.
Loneliness and depression and feelings of isolation, in our view, are viruses just like COVID and can have just as devastating health impacts, particularly on seniors and older adults.
Del Med researchers are currently working to get the results of their study published as soon as possible so the program can be replicated elsewhere.
In Austin, I'm Ashley Lopez. You're on Texas Standard Time.
For some COVID-19 patients, a negative test does not mean they're done with the virus. It's called long-haul COVID, when symptoms like chronic fatigue, respiratory problems, and brain fog can persist for months after contracting the virus. Although doctors know more about long-haul COVID than when the pandemic started, there are still many questions about its effects. For more, we turn to Dr. Esther Malamed. She is an assistant neurology professor at UT Austin's Dell Medical School. Dr. Malamed, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We spoke last fall about these folks who experienced symptoms from COVID-19 months after they first contract the virus. Do you have a better idea now about how prevalent this is?
So, David, there have been studies looking at patients at a couple of weeks, at 3 months, and now the most recent study has looked at patients at 6 months post-COVID. And it appears that this is still very much of a prevalent condition, even going out to 6 months for folks. Mm. And the main symptoms that are experienced include fatigue and headaches, pain. There are persistent neuropsychological symptoms. And we are still learning about this syndrome, but it certainly does appear that even out to 6 months at this point, folks are still experiencing symptoms.
And what separates those whose symptoms persist for so long versus everyone else, or those who seem to get over it in pretty short order?
It's a very interesting question, David. So comorbidities such as obesity and high blood pressure, diabetes, or mental health all seem to predispose patients to a higher risk of getting COVID, as well as to ongoing long-term symptoms. However, it is interesting that even patients who were asymptomatic or had mild disease during the acute COVID infection still continue to have these long-term post-COVID symptoms. And so it is not just the patients who were in the ICU and who had multi-organ damage to the heart, lungs, and the brain that can determine long-lasting symptoms. There's definitely something that we're still not completely understanding in terms of what other effects there may be on the body by the virus in those who may have had mild or even asymptomatic disease.
Well, we've been hearing so much of late about mutations of this virus. Is it possible there could be a particular strain to blame or something else entirely?
That's also a really good question, and with every new finding, there are 10 new questions that are raised, and now that we have learned, we're learning about the different strains of the virus in Great Britain and in several states in the United States and several emerging in other countries, it is certainly the case that some of the strains may predispose to different symptoms. The other possibility that my research team in collaboration with other immunologists and physicians at Dell Medical School are studying is whether there is an emergence of autoimmune diseases post-COVID, and perhaps that may be one of the factors that could explain why people with mild or asymptomatic COVID may continue to experience symptoms post-COVID.
Do there seem to be any distinctions between groups of people when it comes to long-term effects of COVID?
Yes, so we're learning that men are predisposed to getting a more severe disease, but interestingly, women seem to be outnumbering men at a ratio of 4-1 in terms of presenting for long-term COVID symptoms. And it's unclear whether this is a true genetic difference or environmental difference, or it may be that women are seeking care more often than men are. Another question that we will, I'm sure, continue to learn about as we investigate post-COVID syndrome in the coming months.
Obviously, we're going to continue to keep an eye on that research at the Dell Medical School, UT Austin. That's where Dr. Esther Melamed is an assistant neurology professor. Dr. Melamed, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Time now to turn to your questions about COVID-19. We've been asking you to send in whatever inquiries you might have about the pandemic or the vaccine, and we're going to get some answers from Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard. Good to have you, sir.
It's great to be back, David.
All right, so this first question comes to us on Twitter from user Sam. Sam asks, I haven't had a primary care doctor in years since the vaccine is a two-part jab. Will it be available at pharmacies like the flu shot, or will folks need to have a primary care physician to get the vaccine?
Well, Sam is correct that historically flu shots and other vaccinations have been administered in pharmacies under the authorization of that company's medical director without necessarily a medical home. So he should be able to do that under the COVID-19 as well.
You do have to, as I understand it, you do have to go back in for a second shot and make sure it's the Pfizer vaccine, not some other brand, right?
That is correct, and that might be a very difficult record-keeping process. So I can't tell you with certainty how that's going to be maintained.
This next question is from an anonymous listener who asks, I've heard the Pfizer shot is particularly painful because it has to be administered at such a low temperature. Are you aware that that's the case, Doctor? I believe I've heard that the vaccine has to be held at something like negative 70 degrees Celsius.
Well, the vaccine itself is always thawed to a liquid form before administration, so it will be above the freezing point. So the temperature at the time of the vaccination is probably not going to affect any pain or other problems at the site.
I see. Well, that is probably comforting for a lot of folks to know, people who think that it might be injected at a super cold temperature. That's not the case, it sounds like. Another question related to the temperature of that Pfizer vaccine, this one from Thomas Nugent, who asks, should we have more faith in the Moderna vaccine becoming more popular since it doesn't have to be stored at such a low temperature like the Pfizer vaccine? I mean, could that low temperature requirement affect efficacy and distribution as you see it, Dr. Campbell?
Well, I'm confident that our distribution system is going to deliver any vaccine to fairly remote areas without much problem. I understand that these vaccines can maintain their potency under refrigeration for several hours. So although it might be very difficult to have people that are very remote vaccinated, I know that that's feasible with these vaccines.
I was trying to think of another situation in the U.S., at least in recent memory, that might be a parallel when it comes to ramping up for the mass inoculation of Americans. I was thinking maybe polio, perhaps, the polio vaccine back in the 1950s. Can you imagine any parallel? Just how big of a logistical issue is this going to be moving into January of 2021?
Well, I am old enough that I actually helped participate in the vaccine project with polio. I was a Boy Scout back in the
wow.
60s when we were giving out sugar cubes with the Sabin oral vaccine. So it was a project that involved people coming into schoolhouses, to churches, to other places, and lining up for long periods of time to get their vaccination in an oral form. So that was my first experience with a big vaccine campaign, and of course it has virtually wiped out polio in the world at this point. We're getting very close.
Dr. Campbell, one other quick question. I was thinking about the timeline here. It was about March, I recall, when the nation began to go on lockdown. Tell me, come March 2021, where do you think we're going to be with this vaccine and the pandemic at large in Texas?
Well, there will be hundreds of thousands of people safer in some respects because of being vaccinated by that time, particularly our highest risk individuals, the elderly and infirmed who are institutionalized, and of course our frontline workers. I don't think that March is likely to be safe for most of the population, however, that have not been vaccinated. It would still need to do all of the common sense things we've been talked about, including social distancing and wearing of masks, until much later in 2021.
Dr. Fred Campbell is a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School at UT Health San Antonio. He's been joining us regularly over the course of the pandemic to answer your questions. Now, if you have something you'd like to ask the doctor about virus or the vaccine, look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus. You'll find a form there to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for joining us again. Good to talk with you, sir.
It's always great to be of help.
And this has been your coronavirus update for Friday, February 12th, 2021. Stay tuned for the magazine Entertainment Weekly, followed by national news with USA Today at 2, and our local news broadcast with our papers in Odessa and Midland at 3. And then more news from the Wall Street Journal at 6. Finally, tonight at 7, as always on Fridays, we bring you some lighter news and funny readings from On the Lighter Side. That's tonight at 7. Thank you again for joining us, and have a great weekend. We will be back with our regular program. We will be back with our regular program at 1 o'clock Monday afternoon.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 23 with fog. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-teens. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the mid-20s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the upper teens. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program covering a wide variety of topics of interest to people with vision loss. I'm Nancy Goodman Torpy.
And I'm Pete Torpy.
In 2009, I'm sure you guys know, we re-released the first accessible phone, all built in. So you buy an iPhone and, you know, you could turn on VoiceOver right away. You didn't need to install anything. It just worked. And that was really groundbreaking.
And it's incredible to think how far the iPhone and iPad iOS devices have come in the past number of years in terms of accessibility. And today we'll be talking about what's new in the latest release of iOS.
We'll be speaking with Apple's accessibility evangelist, Dean Hudson, about how they've been incorporating advanced artificial intelligence technology to provide new features that can be particularly useful to people with vision loss. But first, for our tip of the week, this week's tip comes from Dean Hudson.
One thing that I think is really cool, and we released this last year, but customizable gestures. I think that's something that is really cool. That's something that allows you to take an existing gesture and assign it to something different. The one I use is stop speech, because I'm constantly taking my phone, putting it in my pocket, taking it out, and I'll inadvertently turn off speech because of the two-finger double tap. And I was like, I don't ever want to turn off speech, so let me just get rid of that gesture.
Oh, that's cute. Well, that is nice. As you say, some gestures may be harder than others or easier, and you use them more frequently or less frequently, and you can just customize it according to your own use.
Yeah.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
Let's start by meeting Dean and learning about his role at Apple.
My name is Dean Hudson. I'm an employee at Apple, and I work as an accessibility evangelist in the policies and initiatives team.
And what does it mean to be an accessibility evangelist?
Well, it means that I work with a variety of teams at Apple on numerous projects. Some sort of legacy, some brand new, we call them black projects, and basically advise them on how to make their products accessible. Sometimes they come to me and they just want to understand, you know, what does it mean to be accessible and how to think about accessibility when building their products.
And you're the perfect person to be in that position, since I understand, although you had some vision when you were a youth, you are blind now.
Yes, I am completely blind.
So you use many of these products?
I use a good deal of them, yes. Except for the high contrast, large text, those are not as useful for me.
I think it makes a big difference when the developers are actually the users. You get a very good product coming out the other end that way.
Yeah, it really does.
And I assume that although your personal experience is with the blindness product, that Apple covers accessibility issues for a wide variety of disabilities.
Yeah, I mean, our main areas are vision, hearing, learning and literacy, and of course, physical disabilities.
Eyes on Success is made possible in part by our corporate partners. Underwriting pairs the impact of targeted marketing with the integrity of community goodwill.
Learn more by sending an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net.
This week's focus topic is Apple's commitment to accessibility and how that is manifested in their devices.
So as you mentioned in the introduction, you work at Apple and you're blind, and coincidentally almost, you've been there since the early days of when Apple started thinking about accessibility. Can you talk a little bit about what some of the early projects you got involved in were?
Yeah, well, Apple actually was thinking about and creating accessibility even before I started. It was sort of the groundwork behind accessibility. But when I got here, it was 2006, and we were about to release OS 10.4, which we called internally Leopard. And that was sort of the introduction of the new voice Alex. I don't know if you guys remember that, but that was a huge deal for us, as well as Braille, for refreshable Braille displays. And it was great. You know, there was a lot of work being done to get out an excellent voice, to get instant Braille access, to plug in your display, and it just works. No drivers, no anything like that. And from there, we just kept expanding. You know, we worked on a lot of different applications, making those work with VoiceOver, our screen reader. And then in 2009, I'm sure you guys know, we re-released the first accessible phone, all built in. So you buy an iPhone and, you know, you could turn on VoiceOver right away. You didn't need to install anything. It just worked. And that was really groundbreaking. And that's something that, you know, we have just continued to do and talk about, just the integration of our hardware, our firmware, our software. And that's what allows us to do uniquely different things and cool things for our users, to really try to make the devices suitable for your needs. So we're very proud of that.
Years ago, all of our devices had buttons associated with them, but somehow another groundbreaking idea that Apple had was to introduce touch screens for even blind people to use somehow. Tell us a little bit about that development.
It took several iterations to get the touch screen correct. But I'm glad it took so long, because we ended up coming up with something that was very, very useful. And I remember before we shipped, I think we announced that we have accessibility on the phone. Between that time and when we shipped, I don't know if you guys remember, there's a lot of talk on the web by accessibility specialists saying, this will never work, blind people like button, you know, you can't use glass. And so we're thinking, man, well, I like it, but I don't know if anyone else. But it turned out to be, you know, now one of the most popular devices for the blind. I mean, it's something like 70% use VoiceOver on iPhone.
Yeah, so it does sound like a strange concept, a blind person working with a device with no buttons and just a flat screen, no tactile indications of what's what. But it works.
Yeah, and it works really well. You know, I used to think, yeah, it's great. Okay, you can do all these things. And more I'm realizing, no, it's not just that you can do these things. iPhone, this is a tool. And especially in these times of COVID, it's like, this is essential. You need this device.
Right, and we've done a number of episodes about enabling apps that are available for the iPhone. Pete uses them all the time.
Yeah, iPhone was a big deal, and we're really proud of that. And I think something that was released in iOS 14 is going to be sort of the next pull for us.
So tell us about that.
That's the VoiceOver recognition. I don't know if you had a chance to play with some of those features.
I play with everything as soon as it comes out.
Well, so it's got three components. The first one I'll talk about is sort of the image description. And in the past, we've done some descriptions of pictures on your phone or photographs, but we've taken it to a different level now. So now we will use on-device machine learning to actually give you full descriptions, full sentences of pictures. So what you might have heard in the past is, you know, photo contains table, chair, person. But now we'll say photo, person sitting in a restaurant drinking a glass of water, something like that.
It is pretty impressive. It gives me some pretty accurate descriptions. And I get a lot of pictures from friends of mine through text messages and emails. It does a great job.
Yeah, yeah.
So another thing that's become very popular, much to the chagrin of blind people, is that their sighted friends will send an image that's a graphic element, but it contains only text. What has Apple done to deal with those images?
The second part of it is being able to recognize text within images. And that's pretty useful. You know, if you seeing a sign or something that's in a picture, could be very useful. I used it one time looking for a shuttle. And as the shuttles were going by, it would tell me which shuttle was there. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. That's really useful.
Yeah, it doesn't help to know it's a bus if you don't know where it's going or which bus.
Exactly. Well, that's true. The third one is really cool, and that we call screen recognition. And in the past, you've probably seen this a lot, Pete, where, you know, you get an application, you really don't know how accessible it is, and, you know, you're going through, and then just a couple of places are good, but then other places is button, and you're just like, oh, man, shoot, you know.
And you have no idea what any of those buttons do or what the function is.
No. And sort of the worst, you know, I've gotten several food ordering delivery apps, and it's just grueling when you order all this stuff and then you go to find the checkout button, but there's no, it's just button. You don't know what it is. And, you know, if I press this one, is it going to delete my order? Or, you know,
a blind person could wind up starving.
But with iOS 14, though, we sort of complement apps. In other words, we use machine learning to detect what that button possibly says. And we use different algorithms and heuristics. So now, you know, it'll say possibly order or possibly check out. We've taken it even further. We know sometimes developers don't include what we call sort of the element description or type attribute for a particular user interface element.
Yes.
And now we can detect buttons, tables, radio buttons, different UI elements within an app. So we find a little bit of a comfort zone for, you know, people who are, quote, working in the blind. We like to do everything we can to make the experience really, really good. And we're taking that even further. So lots of exciting things going on with accessibility and machine learning.
The other feature I think is neat that is part of this new system using the AI that's built into the phones is that now one can use one's camera to sort of scour around the room to have the camera tell you what objects are in the room to give you a little layout of what's going on.
Yeah, that's a big piece of something sort of we got from doing the image description stuff. So now in the camera app as well as the magnifier, two things going on there. What you described, sort of the live view description, as well as people detection that we put into the probes using the LiDAR sensor. And it's very important during this time. And even times where you want to know where, say, the end of the line is, and or has the line moved. You don't want to keep hitting people with your cane. And then the whole COVID thing, just being able to know who's around you, how far they are. And as you said, even sort of looking around you as you're walking down the road, seeing different things appear in your camera's view. Really, really nice.
I think that LiDAR capability that you now have in your higher end new phones will be interesting to see how that develops in the future as it migrates down to lower end models and how you make use of it for the visually impaired. We can be sort of like the self-driving cars these days and just walking around on our own with that technology.
Yeah, you know, it's not going to replace the cane or a guide dog, but it's just interesting to know if you get walk in a neighborhood you're not familiar with just to get to see what's around you. You know, are there buildings? Are there, you know, it's just very cool. Just gives us one more layer of access.
Sure, supplementary information is always a good thing.
Yeah.
So what else do you want to talk about new features in some of your new products?
So we've talked a lot about vision so far, but we also have some cool features for hearing impaired, and that's sound recognition. And this is also sort of part of the whole machine learning. We can detect different categories of sounds, such as household, include someone knocking at the door or a doorbell, appliances, as well as people things like baby crying, someone yelling, and all sort of things that would give notifications to someone who's not able to hear those things very well. It's really something cool, proud of, and getting a lot of feedback of people who really enjoy it. Another feature that you might have saw is the whole back tap. So what we've done is allowed you to either double tap or triple tap with two fingers on the back of your phone and assign that to, you know, a gesture that you use all the time. It could be anything from bring up the control panel or bring up the dock or call an Uber. I don't suggest using that for that, but that's really cool. And it's great for people who, you know, just don't have the dexterity or physical ability to perform some of these gestures that you do on the phone. So,
yeah, that is a nice feature.
Well, the exciting thing about machine learning, it's constantly getting better. You know, we don't have to wait for a release for models to get better. They're just continually improving. So that's also very exciting.
And it's always amazing to me, I look at all the functions built into these phones these days and how accessible they are, and I keep thinking, well, what more can be added? It's already pretty good. And somehow every year something new comes along, some new technology or some new accessibility feature that really improves our access and functionality of our devices.
What do you have that's recently released for people with low vision?
So low vision, we talked about there's been quite a few improvements in the magnifier app. A lot of things that you can now freeze frames, you can get more contrast. A lot of the controls are easier to get to now. You can do multi-documents with the magnifier. So that's really, really coming very, very useful. And what I find a lot of people are just impressed that, you know, you don't have to carry this magnifying glass anymore. You just whip out your phone if you're in a restaurant when we get back to that, and you can view menus if the print's too small. And this is not, you know, people with disabilities, just anyone, you know.
I encourage Nancy to use it sometimes when she doesn't have her reading glasses.
And I do. And it's not just that the print is sometimes too small in the menu. Sometimes the lighting is too miserable or whatever. And you just need a little help being able to see whatever you're trying to see, and I consider myself fully sighted.
Yeah. And I'm sure you're familiar with all the sort of settings in accessibility for low vision, including large text, which is a really big one we released a few releases ago. Just a ton of stuff, high contrast, color blindness, all those things. It's just a complete set of tools that someone with low vision can use. And you have to remember that, you know, you say, well, someone's low vision, you know, that really doesn't tell the whole story. Someone can have only peripheral vision or no central vision. And it's a wide range. So we try to make it very, very customizable so that it fits everyone's visual needs. And the same with other disabilities, right? Someone can be fully deaf or just have hearing in their left ear. So we provide controls so that you can do that. And that's one of the things that we've also improved in iOS 14, sort of hearing accommodations where you could put on your AirPods Pro, and I think it also works with Beats, and then you can adjust, lower or raise the different frequencies that suit your hearing range. So that's a really good improvement for folks who have hearing issues.
The other feature I like in these devices these days is the ability to make one's own shortcuts for functions that take several steps that you may do all the time. So I log a lot of my exercising that way by saying, Siri, log my exercise. And she asks me a series of questions. How long did you do this? How far did you run? How much time did you take, etc.? And it's just all done all by voice.
Yeah, I did that as well. I created a shortcut that if I take a video, I can just say, you know, send video, and it will copy that video into an email and send it to my sister. I take videos of my son's performances, and it was just tedious to, like, be walking out of the theater and, like, have to bring up the videos app and then copy that video and share it to email and then type in my, you know, it's like.
Yep, cane in one hand, phone in the other. It doesn't work so well, does it? Yeah, that's very nice. Talking of programming, the shortcuts involve a little bit of sort of programming, sort of in a graphical way. But you yourself are a programmer, I take it, and have gotten involved in writing some programs in Apple's environment. Can you talk about that and how the accessibility of some of the programming tools in the Apple ecosystem have improved?
My goodness, yeah, there are some huge improvements. And not to get deep down into the technical stuff, but a lot of things that you really need to be able to modify and work in a large code base. So things like jumping between different member functions, being able to navigate breakpoints and edit breakpoints, and you know, just get around code very quickly. Because if you're blind, it's not like you can just see a screen of code and go, I want to go there. You know, we have to go line by line by line, and that's just, it can take you significantly longer. So jumping you to the next error or even code completion is just extremely helpful. And we've done a lot of that. And of course, Apple has invested in Swift Playgrounds and Swifting code. And now that also is accessible. So as you're writing Swift code, you can actually see the immediate results of that code. And that's accessible in iOS 14. So some really cool advancements that we've made to allow you to actually get down in the code and work efficiently. So
for people who aren't familiar with the Swift Playgrounds, can you talk a little bit about that and how it helps people learn to code?
Yeah, so we've actually worked with several schools, Texas School for the Blind and some other ones, California School for the Deaf. What it does is it allows, and it's, this is for everyone, right? It brings coding to a younger elementary schools, children, is what I'm trying to say. And it brings it in a way as a puzzle. So you're trying to solve these puzzles. And what we've done is made that sort of experience accessible with an iPad, including sort of tactile maps of each of the puzzle worlds. And so that kind of helps out when you want to try to figure out where things are in the puzzle, what you need to do to get to those items. And so it's a really good experience for kids trying to learn how to code. And then from there, they move up into actually writing little applications. And that's where a lot of our improvement came this year, is being able to navigate and write code within those environments. So it just gradually builds up from there. And we're really trying to reach out and get a lot of people, you know, not necessarily make them engineers, but, you know, we understand that pretty much any job you want to get, it's good to have some sort of background in coding. And so really don't want blind people to be left out of that. And that's something that's really important.
I agree. And, you know, I think computers are a great field for blind people to be involved in, because these days computers are so accessible. And it's tremendous that you guys are making these tools available and accessible to people at younger ages, because after all, that's the best time to learn some of these skills and know that there are possibilities to be had in those fields.
Yeah, yeah.
You talked a lot about what you can do using VoiceOver, which is basically speech output. Can you talk a little bit about Apple's Braille support?
Yeah, so we're constantly working on that. We've added new tables, I believe, last year to include the LibLui Braille tables. So that gave us a lot more support of different languages. The auto panning was another big one. And then also, just a few years ago, we actually came up with a standard for Braille. In the past, you know, Braille display manufacturer would come to us and say, hey, can you guys write a driver to support our display? And we thought, you know what, why don't we invent a standard? And if the manufacturer follows that standard, they're instantly compatible. So we've got that out, it's published. And so all manufacturers have to do is just comply with that and they will be fully compatible.
That's a great step forward, because you used to get Braille displays in the past, and as you said, if you couldn't get a driver for your particular operating system, you were just out of luck.
Yeah. So we've also included Braille support for the watch.
How does Braille support for a watch work?
So, as you know, Apple's moving towards this independence of watch, not being so much tethered to a device. And there are some things on the watch that are just specific for the watch. So fall detection is one of them. This is something that people got really excited about, being able to use your watch to even send text messages and do all kinds of things. But your heart rate, that's another one that you have to have your watch to do. EKG is another one. So there are some things that come in handy if you are a Braille reader and would prefer to get this information in Braille.
So you're saying you don't necessarily have to have your phone with you. You can just have your watch and get some Braille output.
Right.
That's great. That's a big step forward.
Yep.